The Mad Tech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to today's Mad Tech Podcast. We're recording this on Halloween and we do have a treat for you this morning. I am joined by Kieran O'Kane, Chief Strategy Officer of ExchangeWire. Welcome, Kieran.
Hello.
Rachel Smith, CEO of ExchangeWire. Rachel, welcome.
Thank you very much, John.
And Lindsay Rountree, COO of ExchangeWire. I am in with the C-level. Good morning, Lindsay.
This is not a treat, surely. For no one.
This is an absolute treat. We're going to have a great time today. We're taking a bit of a divergence from our normal weekly news show. And today we're going to be discussing our industry review 2025, which is going to be coming out in January. We have singled out eight pillars that we think are going to define the year ahead. And today we are going to go through each of them, explaining their importance to us, why we think they're going to define the year. And then at the end, we'll be giving you the opportunity to get involved in industry review 2025. I'm going to move us straight on and kick off with our first pillar. It's one of the big ones. It's been a hot topic on everyone's lips at all the events that we've been to this year. And Kieran, you're going to take us through retail media and why it is going to define 2025.
Interesting. You know, from all the sketches we've done this year, Mad Tech sketches on ExchangeWire and the ones posted on LinkedIn, they've had the most engagement in terms of shares.
The ones focusing on retail media.
Yeah, on retail media. The most shares, the most sort of engagement. The one we did last week around the retail media ad stack, which was phenomenal, had, I think, 35,000 impressions and then 35 comments and then like 300, 400 shares. So huge. It just shows you that there's a lot of focus in ad tech around that, and for good reason. Retail media is a big area of growth for the space. We've seen some breakout successes, huge successes, the likes of Uber, which has turned its business into a $1 billion ad business. You can argue it's that retail media, but when we talk about retail media, we talk about commerce media, the broader sort of ecosystem. But like, you know, CTV gets all of the sort of a lot of the accolades, but the reality is, for independent ad tech, retail media is where it's at, right? CTV is effectively just shifting money from linear to CTV. It's not net new money. Retail media is net new money. We're seeing a lot of new marketplaces, a lot of apps just flipping ad businesses on, and bringing endemic advertisers into the space. Like, you could be a massive wine app with thousands of vineyards basically just publishing their wine on the app, and suddenly you could switch on a product listing advertising and you could have like £1 million, £2 million business. That money then is flowing then back into the ecosystem via audience extension. So like, for me, this is the big opportunity. Like, I think next year you're going to get people talking about retail data, which is effectively using, leveraging first party data across the open web and walled gardens, etc. But it's all connected. The money flows from retail media. So I think that this is the biggest part of ad tech and the biggest engine of growth going forward. I could see independent ad tech working really nicely across the space because there are thousands of these. There are going to be probably the likes of Tesco's, the Sainsbury's and Walmart, all those guys, tier one, will have their own managed solution where they sell directly into agencies. There will be opportunity to aggregate tier two, tier three, and I could see new companies popping up to do that. But in parallel, you'll still have those businesses running, you know, Citrus Ad, next to Kevel, Criteo, and running really, really successful retail businesses. And I think feeds into the wider space. For me, this is where all the growth is.
Excellent. Rachel, any thoughts on retail media?
So just building on what Kieran was saying there, I moderated a panel at Mad Tech Money last week on retail media, the opportunity in retail media actually for investors in terms of investing in either ad tech businesses or investing in, you know, businesses that are building out big advertising opportunities. And actually, Martin Jensen from Nexta was on the panel. He talked about his perspective being that retail media is a good conduit to the wider commerce media opportunity, and that in his opinion, and I'm sketching this out because I think it's quite interesting. It's the sort of third wave of advertising. If you accept that perhaps the first wave was search, the second wave was social, the third wave is commerce. And when he described it in that way, and obviously, you know, we'd had a bit of a chat in the getting prepared for the panel session, I started thinking along the lines of Kieran just sketching out the sort of first tier opportunities and second and third tier opportunities in retail media, and started thinking that really any business that's got good quality first party data can build out some form of a retail media offering and connect it with a commerce related business, whether they've got an existing commerce business or whether they're interested in building out a commerce business. And that includes publishers as well, right? So if you've got good quality first party data, you could be thinking about how to activate that first party data in lots of different ways. And one of them might be in a retail media context or a commerce media context. And I think that makes it super interesting. So it's not just, I think when we talk about retail media in marketing and advertising, it's no longer just an opportunity for retailers or classic retail media networks. It's an opportunity to activate on the data that can be used either in an existing retail media network environment or in a new retail media network or commerce environment as well.
So that's where I think the retail data term will become.
Yeah, that's what I'm intrigued by.
Yeah, everybody will be using that, like, that will be a big trend next year. Everybody will be using that term, retail data, to Rachel's point about leveraging first-party data and intent data across the ecosystems. And then, you know, retail media and commerce media bleed into one anywhere. Like, so it's really, it goes back to like with that, remember we talked about that utility publisher thing and we're starting up, it's kind of a bit like that. Like, it's great. This is good for ad tech. The more ad businesses there are, the better, right? Like, the walled gardens are growing for sure. But like, Uber's able to spin up a $1 billion business and it's...
Ad business.
And all falls to the bottom line, which is effectively their profit. But it's like new advertisers, right? It's endemic. It's agency. We talked to Paul Wright, which Rachel did at the same panel, talking about their mix of customers.
Paul Wright from Uber, just to clarify.
Paul Wright from Uber, who's also an LP in first party capital, just for reference.
For a minute I thought you were going to tell me that he was an ex Premier League footballer, which is
he did not play. Well, maybe he did. He's a very interesting man. Maybe he did play football or some other sport.
Good Lord.
Sorry, Paul.
But you know, like, it's got that mix of new customers. And I think that's the exciting part, is that everybody can bring new money into the space. This is what I'm talking about, net new money, right? It's like, think about that wine app I spoke about. It's like all those vineyards, like, they would have never spent through the traditional SSP, DSP, agency war, right? This is new money coming into the space. And that's why I think this is exciting, right? Because we're tapping into that. What do they call it? Felt, the fat end of the long tail, which is what Mr. ITV, what's his name? McLaughlin.
Reese McLaughlin yeah.
Talked about it. The felt, right? This is like classic felt territory, right? Fat end of the long tail.
Yeah, it's a good acronym.
Lindsay, thoughts on retail?
I haven't got much more to add on what Kieran and Rachel said, but it is the data side that makes it, that interests me the most. I mean, and especially kind of what that can do to the non-endemic brands that can access and tap into retail data. It was a few years ago in Singapore where we had Carousel on stage talking about non-endemic advertisers taking advantage of retail media. But you don't really hear much about it, haven't really heard much about it since, and how they can get involved and kind of how they can tap into that data. And I think that certainly that's going to be very, very interesting, because it changes the definition of what a retailer is, and also allows other people to tap into just so much more inventory, so much more understanding of kind of what a consumer is doing. And, you know, like, when I'm talking about non-endemic, I'm talking about, you know, people like insurers and stuff that don't sell a specific good. But that, I think the data side of it is what I think is going to be really one to watch next year.
And also, you just reminded me, Lindsay, I think that taps into another point that was made on the panel at Mad Tech Money last year. James Avery from Kevel was talking about it having a great democratizing effect. It's the idea that actually a retail media network environment with the right type of data can really help those small and medium-sized businesses actually build significant advertising businesses and build them in a really cost-effective way. And so that, I think, is going to help for non-endemic brands as well. And I also think that's just, again, as to Kieran's point, just going to help to grow the channel, the category, the environment, whatever term we choose to associate with it. And so that's good. That's good for advertising. It's good for ad tech.
Yeah, and think about new players like PayPal and Shopify. Like Shopify now apparently are launching an AdSense type business in their own network of sites. That's really interesting. And then obviously PayPal are just basically leveraging that 400 million consumer network they have. And these are good things because these are customers for ad tech. Like, you know, money goes away from the walled gardens into that. So yeah.
And it all sort of funnels down into the idea of you know, delivering people more relevant, better quality advertising connected to consumer intent. Paul Wright was talking about that. That's what they focused on at Uber. They're in the perfect position to do that. They can tell lots of things about what you're doing and when, but in a helpful way from a consumption point of view, getting to that better quality advertising.
Yeah, totally. And I think that as it becomes more endemic across all types of advertisers, not just retailers specifically, I'm also intrigued as to how it will play out and how the infrastructure will change within businesses that operate within retail media. So I'm thinking more about agencies. Like at the moment, obviously there's a lot of different commerce teams and retail media teams. As it becomes more endemic across different types of brands, how will they play it? And it's back to the old kind of TV versus CTV argument, like who owns what? And I think the ownership of the kind of the retail media and commerce media space will start to become very interesting in the agencies too.
Excellent. Well, that's a good overview of why it's exciting and what's coming up next year. I will move us on to our next pillar, purpose. It's a really interesting one. We've seen sustainability kind of given a bit of a rebrand. We've called it purpose this year to kind of differentiate. Rachel, your thoughts on purpose and how we're going to approach the pillar?
Yeah, so I think that the important point here is that, as you just said, John, the focus sort of across the industry last year around reducing the carbon footprint of digital advertising was very much connected to, you know, how we can impact environmental sustainability in the advertising industry in a positive way. I think that agenda has moved on significantly in the last 12 years. And I think we now need to be looking at the concept of environmental sustainability as not something that we do something about or discuss or be active about because it's a business opportunity, because we shouldn't be seeing it through the lens of it being a business opportunity. We should be seeing it for the impact that it has on everything else that we do in advertising and in business in general. So what I mean by that is that we should shift our lens from drilling down into the detail of how we're reducing the carbon footprint of the digital advertising industry, albeit that's very important and we need to still be specific and detailed about that. But from a macro lens, we should be aligning this with how we create sustainable businesses in the advertising and marketing industry in a general context. That then needs to be connected with having some sense of purpose. Brands are really good at this. You know, they define as they undertake their branding exercises, they define usually very clearly a purpose for their products and for their brand. And I think we now need to be drawing a thread across all of those principles. What I don't want is for the industry to be talking about environmental sustainability in a siloed way, because that's no longer appropriate. It needs to be a fundamental element of how businesses operate in this industry. And we then need to be linking all of that to how we build out sustainable businesses in the long term in marketing and advertising. I don't mean just environmentally sustainable. I mean financially sustainable. I mean ethically sustainable. And then that all needs to be linked with a sense of purpose, which will look a little bit different if you're a publisher versus if you're a brand versus if you're a technology provider. But I think it's still a really important part of doing good business. And I would say that the industry now becoming a lot more mature compared with 5-6 years ago, it's a fundamental of doing business. It's just that the world of ad tech was an explosion of technology innovation, and we sort of ignored a few of the fundamental principles of the ways to do business in favour of growth and exciting technology innovation. And I now think that's all catching up with us. Environmental sustainability has been a really good principle to bring us to this place. We now need to use that principle to extend our focus on creating and sustaining good quality businesses and doing business with one another in the right way.
Yeah. Lindsay, thoughts on purpose?
I completely agree with everything Rachel said. I think to add to that, there it feels like, and tell me I'm wrong, but it feels like it's not as prevalent as it maybe was a couple of years ago. The conversation seems to have dwindled. That might be a positive thing. It might be that it's just become this kind of baseline hygiene factor among everything that we do, and it's now not the sole purpose for doing something, but it is just, it's there, and it's kind of, you know, endemic in every kind of, in all the media we're buying and kind of what we're using. I'm interested to see kind of what that looks like going forward though, because often when things don't get talked about, does it mean they're forgotten? And how does that mean the conversation within brands is changing? The conversation within ad tech's changing? Is everyone still going after kind of being environmentally sustainable when it comes to their looking at the bid stream, when it comes to everything they're doing kind of within a brand as well? Like I'm intrigued as to whether the silence is just means like we've got this covered now, we've got this sorted, or if it just means that people don't quite care as much as they did. And, you know, obviously there were lots of conversations around greenwashing as that just kind of everyone's just secretly admitted, yeah, we were all greenwashing, so we may as well just stop talking about it. That's my concern.
It's interesting because I've spoken to Hannah Mercer from the Responsible Marketing Agency this year a few times. I've spoken to JB from Greenbids about this, and they've mentioned the concept of green hushing, which I like. It's not that stuff isn't going on. It's just that there's a certain fear now associated with being accused of greenwashing or being kind of called out immediately. So people are trying in the background very hard to back themselves, but are a bit scared of making sustainability their kind of key cornerstone of their business because it's easy to call out. It's easy to have not done 100% the right thing. And I thought that concept was really interesting in terms of, because it has quietened down. I mean, we couldn't move for panels on sustainability a couple of years ago. Now it's just not what people are talking about as much. So yeah, I found that fascinating that the greenwashing has then led to green hushing, which has led to a quieter outlook, but something nonetheless incredibly important.
And that's the thing, you know, we absolutely need to make sure that it hasn't gone quiet because people are just quietly hoping it will go away because it was a bit of a difficult thing to do. Or like John said, they're nervous about being, flushed out in a public forum for not doing enough or not doing as well as they'd committed to doing, etc., which is one of the reasons why I just want to see it as a fundamental pillar of doing good business, along with some other pillars that are equally associated with purpose. Because I think as an industry of mature professionals, that's the way that we should be doing business. I've said this before, so I don't want to bore listeners to death on this, but I often hark back to my time of working in the public sector when we always had and still do have environmental sustainability targets around the services that we were delivering. And I was working in the public sector at a local authority level. So you're talking about your local council who's responsible not just for the bins and the recycling, but the schools, certain elements of the roads and some of the road traffic arrangements around your neighbourhood, social services, housing, a whole raft of schools. I already said schools, didn't I? A whole raft of services that are knitted together in your local neighbourhood. And there was environmental sustainability targets associated with every single element of delivering those services, as well as what your offices looked like and, what kind of recycling arrangements you had in your offices and in the town halls, etc. And that's been going on for like 30 years, longer, 30 years. So it's just that we as an industry need to keep pace with that. We need to hold ourselves to account for that as well. So I just want it to be more of a fundamental pillar of the way that we do business across each corner of businesses in advertising and marketing, so that people feel less like they're completely in the spotlight if they come out and talk about it, and so that people don't just sort of quietly hope it goes away or forget about it.
Yeah, moving us on to our next pillar, and this one's Privacy First World. It's been a heck of a year with Google announcing their date for cookie deprecation. postponing it and then ultimately cancelling deprecation completely. But I think our thought is that, you know, it's time to really prepare on your own terms. Lindsay, talk us through Privacy First World and why it's going to define next year.
So I think that we originally thought that Google would define Privacy First World, and it's a bit of a breath of fresh air that that's not the case. But as we've said multiple times on many different forums at Exchange Wire, it's irrelevant what Google are doing. You need to be focusing on this. You need to be focusing on kind of making yourself cookie free, and not necessarily completely cookie free, but reducing your reliance on cookies significantly and focusing on privacy for many, many different reasons. And I feel like in terms of readying yourself for a privacy first world, it almost requires a cultural shift as much as it requires a technical one. And it's a mindset around understanding your consumers and understanding kind of what the limits are of what you want to do with data, how you want to understand them, how you want to target them, how you want to track them. And there's a lot of different kind of directions that people can go with that. Fundamentally, there are concerns around, what am I doing? Is it correct? Am I doing the right thing? Like the beauty of Google kind of calling the shots was that everyone would go, okay, well, if Google's doing that, I'll just wait for them to do it and then I'll go and follow suit. Now everyone's got to try and find their own path, and that can be more complicated. And it does mean people having to go away and kind of step back and try and understand the landscape themselves more prominently. Ad tech is there to help with that. Like ad tech is there's so many different companies out there that can help you get ready for it, but you need to understand yourself kind of what your limitations are. I mean, we had this conversation at ATS London as well, kind of around privacy and the focus on privacy. And you know, and that conversation and just many conversations in general with kind of people across the industry, there's, you know, a few things that have become clear about privacy focus. It differs, especially among brands, it differs vastly in terms of maturity across brands, especially among those UK operations. If you're a UK focused business versus a global business, your level of maturity when it comes to privacy is completely different. And your understanding of the different data regulations are completely different. The understanding of GDPR outside of the EU walls is kind of almost non-existent. And businesses outside of that see these laws as restrictive. And we've seen that. We've seen that within ad tech. We've seen people ignore Europe because GDPR just feels too complicated. And they've just kind of bypassed Europe and gone from the US straight to Asia because that feels like it's more akin with what they're used to. And there needs to be that understanding of that and how it ties in with the consumer. Again, the kind of the person, the human is lost in all of this quite a lot of times. It's always about the data. And we need to kind of, I guess, think of things from like a see ourselves as like data stewards rather than data owners. And there's been a big conversation around data minimization and the importance of that. Like, what data do we need? How are we going to use it? How do we want to kind of make sure it's as effective as possible, and kind of where are we pulling it in from? And there needs to be a lot of understanding between the brands, agencies, tech and the publishers in terms of what that looks like, and much greater transparency across the supply chain, especially from the brands, the publishers, and how they work together and how they are educating the people that are using their products, either being the publisher sites or kind of or the goods and services they're buying through ads. That needs to improve massively. And that comes down to transparency in the supply chain, but also building that trust and educating. I think that's going to be a big, big aspect of this. But I think it's a scary one, and people are kind of waiting for other people to jump and make moves and not readying themselves the best way possible for what is undoubtedly going to be a fairly interesting year when it comes to understanding kind of what your alternatives to cookies are and how that ties in with having a privacy first approach.
Kieran, thoughts on the privacy first world?
Yeah, it's complicated landscape. Privacy sandbox hasn't been the success that Google thought it was. The Google deprecation strategy or rollout has been complete shit show, let's be honest with you. Google have just completely dropped the bomb. I don't know whether they're doing it deliberately or not. It's hard to gauge. Either way, I agree with Lindsay, you kind of have to walk outside of Google, as in like you almost have to kind of like accept that they're not going to be the solution to the problem. We need to figure out what signals work in a post-cookie world. We'll talk about some of them later on, but yeah, it's a tricky one because it's kind of like, I think people are fatigued around Google in general, whether it's like their sort of antics and let's be sort of foul ups in this sort of process, the DOJ trial and all the sort of like talk of Google breakups. you kind of have to, I can see why agencies would over-index to Chrome. It's just easier. It's still there. Cookies are still there. It's just easy to kind of like build the plans and have it as your KPIs and use it as your measurement piece. But it's not a sustainable approach. And I think that weirdly, like without Google, the industry's kind of moved on to Lindsay's point that there are brands, there are agencies that are adopting privacy first sort of solutions. And I think we haven't really seen new areas emerge. Like I think I'm a big fan of seller defined audiences. I think like contextual use in that way, appended to other signals, will be really interesting. I think there's loads of innovation to come. What we really need to do is get, you know, Google to pull the plug. But then there are issues with that, like, you know, the Forum for Freedom of the Internet. What do you call it? The guy who was on the panel at London?
James Movement for an Open Web.
Movement for an Open Web.
Forum for Freedom and Open Internet. It's very catchy. I
mean, James should consider renaming
that. Could have been the second hard choice when he was picking the thing. Who knows?
It made top three.
It didn't make the top five. Let's put it that way. You know, he'll make the exact, it will kill mid to long tail publishers. Yeah, there's a lot of things that kill mid to long publishers, TikTok and all the walled gardens and et cetera. It's not just cookies. I am so conflicted by this topic. I genuinely think that Google are playing silly buggers, but it was like on a different level.
I
believe that they're deliberately trying to create their network business and the open web so they can funnel more money into search and YouTube. Like you can see it from the earnings. But regardless of their sort of like 3D chess games and their MBA gobshites working in the company, we as an industry need to move on and invest in new technologies. I think that's what I'm excited about with this most.
Yeah. Rachel, your thoughts on privacy first?
Yeah, I would add to that by saying two things. The first is, I think it actually links with my previous point. The point here is that people need to move on from third-party cookies and build sustainable businesses based on based on fundamental tools and levers that will be in existence forever. You can't build a business based on targeting via third-party cookies because you're not in control of that. So you need to think about the ways in which you're building out your business. And that works for everybody, including, you know, advertisers thinking about how they're reaching their audiences. That's point number one. Point number two, I agree with Kieran. I think actually this is, regardless of what happens with Google concerning cookies in the coming few months, because we know what their intentions are, and that as a result of those intentions, it's quite likely that consumers will just, elect to deprecate cookies in and of themselves. There's also obviously the awaiting final outcomes of the various anti-competition trials that are underway and findings, because Google will be no doubt launching appeals on some of those findings. But ultimately it's going to result in an environment where there's so many different places that you can be finding your consumers. So if you're a brand or an advertiser, you need to be adopting a number of strategies in order to get your messages out to those, to get those messages out to consumers. And that's going to involve using a range of tools and tactics and techniques. And that's where we need to see some growth in technology innovation. We've already seen some really interesting things happen over the last 12 months.
There's lots of cool companies in that space right now.
Absolutely. And there's going to be many more emerging, and we'll get onto some of that in a bit. But that's where I really see this data piece going. And Lindsay's right. The privacy thing is the thing that's going to help continue to focus people's minds on what they can and can't do. But people need to move beyond whatever the hell Google is or isn't doing, create sustainable business models in and of themselves, and think about a range of tools and solutions that they engage to get the best advertising experience to the potential customers that they want to find, and think about the variety of places they're going to find them.
Excellent. Cool. I will move us on to our next pillar now, which is the future of entertainment. I'll give the overview for this one. It's a bit of a Trojan horse, future of entertainment, because there's a few aspects to it that we'd like to talk about in it. Obviously, CTV is a huge part of the future of entertainment pillar. It's one of the big things that we're talking about this year. An incredibly fragmented space, I'd say, but so much opportunity in there. We're quite bullish about it. But it depends a lot on what market you're in, what the possibilities are, but lots to talk about on CTV. Gaming is also in there. The year of gaming seems to have been the new year of mobile. We've been talking about it for a long time, but the opportunities of gaming are still there to be exploited. And we'd love to hear some of the innovations that are coming out of the sphere at the moment. Another is audio. Again, something that had a lot of traction a couple of years ago and is still bubbling away. But we'd like to hear more about it. It's something that I'm very, very interested in, seeing how innovation can happen in that sphere this year, particularly in Singapore. It was a lot of people were talking about that in the networking area with the possibilities of audio. So I'm very keen to see how that shakes out. But in general, the opportunities of entertainment, it's so wide ranging, but the audience is there, the demographics there that can be advertised to, that can be reached. It's such a huge market. Kieran, your thoughts on CTV, etc.
So, yeah, I think I agree with you. I think there's a huge opportunity. The future of Tim is great. That's a great pillar. It's nice, tasty sort of verticals in there. I think that the CTV has been talked about quite a lot. It's very different from the European perspective is very different from the United States, right? So US has got lots of massive CTV platforms, as in like, you know, content platforms, streaming platforms, on-demand platforms. So it's quite a sort of diverse ecosystem. Here we still have broadcasters dominating the landscape, regardless of what linear consumption is happening. A lot of people have moved on to ITVX and Channel 4. Like, their numbers speak for themselves. They haven't gone away from those platforms. And then you have Amazon Prime and Netflix. So Amazon Prime obviously have a very good ad business. It's doing very well in Europe at the minute because they're running ads against most of their programming. And Netflix will be there. So it's a very concentrated space in Europe. Where I do think there's interesting stuff is around live streaming sports. That for me is really interesting because I think ad tech really hasn't figured that part out yet. And I think there's going to be a lot of innovation around that. Speaking to a few of the ad tech executives, I did ask them straight out, where's the opportunity here? Like, how do you compete with incumbents? This is like, there's still huge problems, right? So like a lot of these platforms will be buying sports rights. Netflix have bought the WWE and Amazon's bought some premiership rights and NFL and all the rest of it. So more of these platforms are going to buy sporting rights, and the actual, the function of trying to get advertising into those live streams is complicated, right? So technically there's a lot of opportunity there. I'll just go into audio. I think audio is huge. Obviously with Spot Exchange has launched their own ad exchange there recently. That's a huge sort of,
Spotify.
Yeah.
Spot Exchange.
That's a
throwback.
Did I say Spotify or Spot Exchange?
You said Spot Exchange.
Wow.
Which really is a throwback in the past.
Yeah. They're Magnite bought them. Wow. Sorry. That is a lack of sleep. Spotify have launched their own ad exchange, which for their own audio, but they're doing video stuff. Look, the explosion of podcasts, the consumption habits of people, it's completely changed. People are not listening as much radio, but they're listening on streaming shows, on podcasts. There is massive opportunity there is clearly a massive demographic, a massive audience there that needs to be tapped. And audio and radio have traditionally been very, very strong channels for advertising brands. And I see a resurgence there. I'm pretty excited about that. Those are like, what was the other one there? Gaming. Who could forget gaming? I mean, it's...
Someone who hasn't had much sleep?
Look, gaming's has made the hard yards. It really has been trying to convince the brands that you need to spend money in gaming ads or whatever. I mean, Activision Blizzard has shown a huge success. A big shout out to Big Greg Carroll and his team who've managed to sort of convince agencies to spend a lot of money there. But the rest of the industry is starting to make inroads, I think, and we're going to see more. I think that's it's a long game. I don't, the big bang we all expect isn't happen, but incrementally they're getting there. I can see it growing and growing. And that's a good thing for them, I think, rather than like, so it's the year of gaming. No, it's not the year of gaming. Every day is gaming. Everybody's playing games. It's just a matter of convincing brands that there's a real ability to reach audiences and show outcomes against the campaigns they run there. So, yeah.
Rachel, thoughts on entertainment?
Yeah, a couple of things. I think what's interesting about the future of entertainment as a pillar is it's all about where the audiences are, where they can be found and where those audiences are going, how they're moving, how consumption habits are changing and so forth. And that's where obviously the advertising opportunity is, and that's where we're starting to see tech innovation grow and become really interesting. So, you know, advertising in a CTV environment or a streamed television environment has gotten that much more sophisticated since some of the big streaming platforms have launched their ad-funded businesses. There's been all sorts of complications around that, the cost of buying ads in some of those platforms, and all sorts of, you know, technical hitches along the way, glitches rather along the way. But it's now becoming commonplace, right? I'm one of millions and millions of Netflix subscribers that was, and Amazon Prime subscribers that was shunted onto the ad-funded tier, which was a genius move on behalf of both of those companies to immediately build out ad revenue. And I'm fine with it. You know what? I'm fine with it.
You pay for Sky and you watch ads.
Exactly.
It's become part of my life now and I'm totally fine with it. For the time being, the ad experience isn't intrusive. It's pretty good quality. It tends to be generally relevant. It's all good. So, even in sort of a 12-month window, that's changed dramatically from when we were having a conversation about TV last year. So all of that stuff makes it really interesting. Audio is super interesting because I think it is where you're finding all sorts of audiences. So people are listening to radio in different ways to how they used to listen to radio. There's also lots of audio opportunities in outside of European countries where a lot of people still spend most of their time in cars going from A to B. It's a bit different in a lot of European countries that got good public transport, but then people are listening to podcasts on the way to work there. And it's also about discovery. I was just having a chat with my 21-year-old nephew last night about how he's a massive Oasis fan, not because his dad was an Oasis fan, but because he discovered it by just listening to other playlists on Spotify, and they shunted him onto some, you know, Oasis tracks 10 years ago.
Which ones though?
Which Oasis tracks? His favourite, now get this, was Supersonic.
Good man.
Oh, great track. Okay. My favourite.
First single and still the best song they've ever done.
And he said it popped up on one of his suggested playlists and he'd never heard it before. So
I mean, like, there are people who paid money for those tickets. Don't bother, hey? Don't bother. You want to pay for Noel Gallagher's divorce? Good luck to you.
That's a whole other podcast in itself. The middle-aged bloke and his Oasis tickets. I digress, but yeah, I just think that there's an enormous amount of opportunity in entertainment channels. And what I also think is exciting, stuff around sports is really interesting, especially that communal moment in sports.
In time, isn't it? Like
event-driven TV, and we don't have so many of them anymore. So that makes it super interesting ad opportunity. And the other from our podcast earlier on in the year, John, with lovely Claire, can't remember her surname, from Pearl and Dean, advertising. Cinema is still a massive opportunity and actually a really strong growing channel. And it's just a reminder that people want to be entertained and the environments in which they're entertained are becoming all the more interesting, and there's plenty of ad opportunities there too.
Excellent. I'm going to move on to the next pillar as we are close to, we're running out of time. Attention, Ciarán, huge area, so, crack on.
Look, attention replaces verification. I have a theory that ad tech is bifurcating into like a signal bucket and then a media execution bucket. So what I mean by that is like signals like attention, context, they're like super important in the post-cookie era. And I think of all the signals that attention is for me is the most important one in the space right now in a post-cookie world. Look, there's a lot of companies out there pushing enhanced viewability, which is effectively, you know, using campaign data to sort of like build models. I think you need real-time attention, like real-time panels to do it properly. And I see more and more people adopting it. Like, so for me, it's still one of the most important segments of ad tech, and I think that I don't think you standardize attention. I think custom attention is going to be working in different environments. Like a gambler might have a gambling intent, or might have a different sort of attention piece than a car buyer. So you know, I think there's loads of innovation around in here, and for me, in a post-cookie, privacy-first world, attention is the number one signal
for the space.
Lindsay, thoughts on attention?
I mean, I haven't got much more to say from what Ciaran said, but I just think obviously there is hype around it for good reason. Like everybody is wanting to understand it and get involved with it. You do have some schools of thought that just say, look, attention is just another lever we can pull. It's actually no different from any other kind of lever we would pull when it comes to optimizing a campaign. But if you look at how attention is being bought and the signals are being optimized, it becomes a very, very interesting proposition. And as Ciaran said, it's replacing verification. That's a very interesting model, especially, you know, we've talked about verification on the podcast last week and talking about kind of the challenges of brand safety and the fact that, you know, you've got agencies like Bountiful Cow are actually building a tool to allow them to build brand unsafe inventory because that's how ridiculous kind of verifications come when it comes to brand safety. Actually, if we're using metrics like attention instead, that could be really interesting for us and it could actually help us be able to categorize inventory differently, looking at understanding around the context of a page rather than looking at kind of trying to block through keywords. It could change the way that we actually are buying inventory and we're actually kind of listing inventory as safe or unsafe. And that's, I think, what makes it really interesting. Yes, okay, fine, it is another lever that can be pulled, but it is arguably a lever that can do a lot more than maybe other levers can. And I think that's where there's going to be a lot of conversation around making sure it's being used to its maximum capabilities and understanding exactly where attention fits in.
Yeah. Rachel, any thoughts on attention?
Only to underscore what Lindsay and Ciaran have said. I think it's a fundamental optimization tool of the future, really. You know, it's interesting to see how it has evolved over the last couple of years, but it needs to be baked into everyone's campaign planning to some extent, from what I can tell.
Yeah, excellent. Cool. Moving to our next pillar, curation. We've seen the rise of curation. We've seen the backlash to curation. We've seen the backlash to the backlash against curation.
That's when you've made it, when you got a backlash against the backlash.
Yeah, that's it. This has all happened in the last month.
I think Ciaran made that up.
So, Lindsay, curation is going to be a big one. Tell us about it.
Yeah, I mean, what a flurry of negativity it's had recently. And I think that, you know, I'm from everything you read, everyone I've spoken to, it feels like those that exist in the curation world are saying that those that are naysaying curation just don't understand curation. And so, again, it's an interesting one to look at. I think it does largely come down to a distinct lack of understanding of what curation is and what curation can do. And I think that especially we're seeing that across Europe, where there's a lot of different schools of understanding of what curation is. And a lot of the backlash is around, what's the purpose of it? Is it actually doing anything? Is it actually cannibalizing the competition? Is it something that just a DSP can do? Is it just another form of ad network? What's data curation? What's kind of, you know, what are the different options of curation and why would it be any different to kind of what we've done before? And it does feel like it's, you know, curation is a hark back to the days of just being able to call up the sales house of the FT and say, I want to buy this. And I think that's important because it fundamentally is intrinsic to the transparency that we talk about so much in terms of that's required in the industry. Curation arguably is going to help elicit some of that and help kind of bring more transparency across the supply chain because it is allowing brands to have more control over what they're buying, where they're buying it, like where they're buying it, who they're buying it from, the number of partners they deal with. Curation does streamline a lot of that. But I feel like it's being made to be more complicated than it is because it really isn't that complicated in terms of understanding, It's the PMPs of old just souped up a bit, really, but it's being made to become complicated to make it sound like it's something new and shiny. We do this really well within advertising. We're able to make things really complicated to kind of try to make people go, yeah, I want to buy that. It sounds amazing. Like, I don't need to understand it. Just let me buy it and let me use it. But I think if we dumbed it down a bit and kind of were more transparent, ironically, about what it actually is and does, I think the understanding of it would be a little bit clearer. There's a lot of questions around it, and I think that I'd like answers to them in terms of, you know, concerns from publishers around, is it actually reducing their margins? Is it actually kind of like reducing trust in kind of, is it opening up trust for them? Is it opening up trust in inventory that buyers wouldn't otherwise have bought? Or is it actually obfuscating it and making it harder for them to do their job? What's buy-side curation? What's sell-side curation? Like, let's just like be open and honest about, and, you know, we've got some amazing sketches around curation that we've done that kind of really do simplify that. But I think that there's going to be ongoing arguments about this for a while.
Yeah, Kieran, thoughts on curation?
Oh my God.
So many thoughts on curation.
I mean, this is the biggest thing in ad tech, I think, because it feeds into a lot of things like transparency, you know, the idea of like being able to build curated media, right? And then the definitions Lindsay talked about, buy side versus sell side. But I think this comes down to like what we talked about, this ad tech middle, right? The explosion of value in the middle, right? And it would feed into take rates as well, right? So the reason why there's a fight over this is because if you go through a demand side, right, platform, you're paying the 20, you're paying the 15 or whatever the agreed, but plus all the data costs, which could add up to about 30%. Who knows? 20, 30%. If you come in via the sell side, it's via deal ID, there is a transparent fee plus the DSP. So the DSP is missing out on the data costs. I think that both the SSPs and DSPs are taking too much in terms of margin, right? I think curation is a good thing. I don't think it's bad for publishers. What the problem I think is going to emerge is sort of where does that extra fee cut? Because the take rate in ad tech is way too high, in my view, especially around the execution layer. I just can't see how you can justify 30, 40% of every dollar, every pound, every euro going through those platforms is taken away. And that's money that's taken away from working media, from publishers, or from the middlemen who are actually doing the adding the ingredients to make this work. There's a lot of people pushing from different sides. I think this is going to be such a big, big thing next year, because you can't kill it, right? It is out. And I think that both brands and agencies love it. Because one, for the brands and our friends from Coca-Cola want to build their own curated inventory set globally. That's incredible. Like, they want to build it for each country because they want quality, transparency, and sites that actually work for them from a performance piece. From the agency side, it's a whole new business, right? They can go to their clients and they go, we can do curated media for you across, which is a service they've been doing anywhere, but now we can do it at scale. For every single client that has every different KPI, you can build something different. Now, you could argue that a DSP algo could do all that anyway. That's neither here nor there. But maybe there's a reason why people want to have it sell site. So there's this sort of like push and pull. And Index say it's the fastest growing product of all time. And that shows you the growth that's coming our way. So I think that the reason why there's a backlash is because people are worried on the demand side they're not going to get as much margin from data activation. And I think that doing stuff from the sell side increases efficiency and transparency. But you can still do demand side curation. Maybe you don't take 30%, maybe you take 10%, maybe you take 5%. But I think this curation feeds into a bigger discussion around the take rate stuff next year.
Interesting. Rachel, any thoughts on curation?
Well, I think Kieran sort of dropped the mic on that, really. Yep. But I suppose all I'd say to add or to underscore is I agree very much that it is curation. I think the current debate around curation is focusing on the point and the viability of that mad tech middle. What's happening in the middle section of the technology layer within ad tech? What role and purpose do each of those technology tools and solutions provide? Who's providing the most value, and where is that value coming from, and who is it important to? So in a curated deal, who's getting the most value and transparency out of that? As Kieran said, brands and agencies really love it. Lindsay's point, it's important to understand if publishers are getting exactly what they need out of it as well. Kieran, you say they are, so that's great. But I think it just underscores how much movement is going on in the ad tech stack, particularly in that middle layer. And it's going to be a really interesting coming 12 to 18 months.
It does feel like an ad tech echo chamber conversation. If the buy side are happy, the sell side are happy, is everyone in between arguing because they're all trying to get involved in curation in some way, and it's going to feel like a bit of a fight to a death.
It's going to be a collapse of fee structure. What you're going to see next year is, because of curation, is that some of the SSPs could live on 3 or 4% take rate. and we probably know who they are, and others cannot. And then on the demand side, the fees are going to have to shift. I'm not like, you know, I think the ad tech middle is the future of the business. And there's nothing wrong with DSPs and SSPs at all. But I think that becomes commodity. It's almost like, you know, a server cost or whatever. But it again, shouldn't really be...
You could argue that this tussle is a democratization of the tech solutions.
This could be the big... This is the big one next year. From this very subject, you're going to see a wider conversation around the actual take rates, because it's starting to eat in... Like, you talk about publishers, right? They'll complain because it's another fee. And it's a fair point, right? If you're paying a DSP fee, an SSP and curation fee, what's left for the publishers? What we should be doing is freeing up working media so the yields the publishers are getting are higher. And the only way to do that is to say, you know what? The people in the middle who are actually making these curated deals, who are actually providing something and doing stuff, they should be getting more margin to either buy media at a higher rate or they should be making more money themselves. And downstream, the DSPs and SSPs or the execution layers should be reducing their take rate. Now, it's going to be very controversial, but we're always ahead of the curve. I'm telling you, this is going to be the big topic next year, and curation is going to be the start of it.
Excellent. Well, Rachel and Kieran, you've both mentioned the publishers there, and our penultimate pillar for today is the new publisher. Very interesting position publishers are in at the moment. Rachel, tell us a little bit more about that pillar.
Yeah, I just think that publishers have kind of been through all of these phases in and of themselves that we've talked about today. So they've really leaned into things like attention and context to make sure that they are maximising the opportunities from their inventory and making it easy as possible and as transparent as possible for buyers to buy that inventory. They've focused, not every single publishing business, but we've really talked about this a lot in the context of publishers over the last sort of 4 or 5 years. They've focused really heavily on building out good first-party data infrastructure and good first-party data assets. They've needed to prepare themselves for a post-cookie environment. They've needed to, lean into anything that has meant they would be impacted by cookie deprecation. They've been hugely impacted by and therefore had to prepare for various episodes of privacy compliance and what advertising and marketing means in a privacy compliant world. And then they've also, I think, come to a position where they've arguably they could, because a lot of them have got good quality first party data, as I mentioned earlier on in the chat, they could be businesses that could be making money in retail media or a commerce media environment as well, depending on what type of assets they've got. And we all know of publishers that have got really diversified businesses and diversified business models with subscription models, with commerce sites, with all sorts of, various different strands where they could be maximizing advertising revenue as well. So why I mention all of that is because I think that the modern publisher is actually an incredibly agile business, because they've had to be. And I think this coming 12 to 18 months is going to be really interesting to see how those publishers' business models shape up. If we think about this time last year, we were just getting into the weeds of having discussions with the likes of The Telegraph that were really leaning heavily into attention. We're now 12 months on. Their big play has been a diversification of revenue streams. What does that look like another 12 months down the line? These are businesses that have had to be really front-footed in terms of building out a very diversified revenue model and having, again, what I mentioned earlier on in our conversation, a sustainable plan for their business for the future. So I think publishers are in a better position than they've been. If we row back to the very early days of ad tech, they've learned a lot of lessons along the way. I think it will now come down to the machinations of what we just talked about with respect to movement in the technology layer, and also to how well they're able to continue to follow that consumer journey, because we all agree that at the end of the day, especially with advertising and marketing, you've got to follow where audiences are. So what do people's consumption habits mean for publishing businesses, and how's that impacting the way they stack up their revenue model?
Yeah. Lindsay, thoughts on the new publisher?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think that everything Rachel said, I completely agree with. It the challenge here is kind of what size publisher you are and what type of publisher you are. If you are a premium publisher, this is, it's never easy, but you have more resource to be able to diversify and be able to find out, find new revenue streams and try to kind of build a model that's going to work for you from a business perspective. It is the long tail that gets affected by this. It is the smaller publishers that just want to focus on content that are trying to monetize their content in any given way possible. And kind of, that's why they have every single possible ad net on their site, ad unit on their site, trying to monetize inventory. Everything happening at the moment, you know, from whatever Google's doing, from AI to everything else, are affecting how they are able to make money and how they're, and what their survival looks like. And they're going, they'll be the ones that will struggle. You know, we've got the, we published an interview with Justine Roberts, the founder of Mumsnet, on ExchangeWire yesterday. And it's interesting because they are a larger premium publisher, but they're also independent and they've struggled. And they obviously taking OpenAI to court about kind of, we went to you and we said, do you want to license our content? And OpenAI went, no, and then went ahead and sold it anyway. And there's those kind of things that are going to affect these publishers from being able to diversify. It makes it more and more challenging. If you are a large publisher, it's slightly easier for you because you have more options out there. But if you're a smaller publisher, you really are stuck between a rock and a hard place. And that's, I think, the challenge that we need to probably as an industry talk more about and make sure we're helping them be able to kind of keep, you know, the open web as available as possible, because that's really their only option.
Yeah. Kieran, thoughts on new publisher?
I think that if you're a mid to long tail publisher, you're in real trouble. If it's an ad based business you have, you're even in bigger trouble than I thought, than I said previously. I think, to Race's point, diversification of revenues, because I think what I probably see is that a lot of publishers will start implementing technologies which would track any crawler that is informing an AI product, and there will be a revenue stream for that. I think we're in this new age where we have this curated open web, and the mid to long tail are going to struggle unless they have an audience that's loyal to them, where they can basically have events, or they can have some other revenue stream. I think the passerby traffic sites are in trouble, real trouble. Like, and I don't know what you do to help them. I mean, I'm being very honest here. Like, I've ran over career, ran a bunch of long tail sites and ran AdSense, and it did pretty well for a while. But AdSense has effectively collapsed now, like in terms of revenue. So there's no way to make money creating content. I'm taking the Brian Morrissey sort of Radiohead thing.
Fairly,
here, like,
negatively cringe.
I'm on a road. But the ones that survive the curated web, that have brilliant audiences, brilliant brands, they're going to be fine. They're going to do really well. They'll have direct sold business. They'll have first party businesses. And I think the ads they serve on their site are going to be high yield. Like, and if you want to work in ad tech with publishers, it won't be shitty display. It'll be high yielding tech or high yielding advertising technology that makes money for publishers. And that's why I think this bleeds into the curated conversation. Yeah, sure. Like, cherry picking, I don't agree with that. If you're able to get £10 CPM out of a curated deal versus what, two out of the open web, what are you going to go for? Like, you know what I mean? There is no real cherry picking. It's just inventory, right? It's just inventory management. So there are ways to make money. I think that the challenge is for the mid to long tail. I think it's a hard, hard road unless you pivot your business to what Rachel talked about, a very diversified business that has multiple revenue streams, that's not just dependent on advertising. Because I think that long tail open web is collapsing on itself. Like, just advertisers want to spend money in new channels that have growth, like audio and CTV and retail media, particularly retail media, because it's outcomes based stuff. If you want upper funnel, you're going to spend money on the Telegraphs and the Guardian to push down those traffics, or that traffic into sort of lower funnel. So yeah, this will be an interesting one to see what people are talking about there.
Yeah. Well, as you all sort of hinted at, one of the major challenges for publishing is going to be AI. And AI is our final pillar. We could not ignore it. It's everywhere at the moment. It's ubiquitous. AI is in every conversation. And it is our final pillar. It's really interesting. It's both a massive challenge and an opportunity for the industry, really, from hyper-personalization of creative, of data analysis like never before, using it for the analytics side. It's not a new area for ad tech. It's, you know, ad tech's been talking about AI for a long time, but the size of the market now, it's incredible. I saw that old Musk is now wants to value XAI at $45 billion this morning.
He wants many things.
I mean, we can do a podcast about that guy. He can go to hell, but it's an awful, you know, there's so much money and so much investment going into this. We've seen record amounts of money go into OpenAI. We have seen the same perplexity looking at mind-boggling valuations.
I think the tech sector is setting themselves for a massive fail. There is going to be blood on the carpet here. What use is it?
What, like, do you mean a crash?
We've spent so much money on these companies. What's the value? Right, scrape a bunch of websites and sped up some magic answers that are half the time wrong. Where's the utility? Like, the grand, I can see utility being used in gene therapy and stuff, but like, that's super focused application.
You don't think it'll replace search?
I mean, like, yes, to an extent, but like, there's so much money being spent in it, right? We're all using the same, like, the LLM thing is more, eventually everybody's going to get the same level of return in terms of like utility from these LLMs, right? What happens then? Like, someone said today, I saw a LinkedIn article about if everybody just used, if all the agents start using LLMs to create copy and creative, right?
It'd all be the same.
It'll all be the same. So I'm very skeptical. Like from a first party capital point of view, I see decks all the time for AI, the same stuff over and over. I'm going, where's the moat? Where's the defensibility? Like, the insane amount of capital these companies are using, the insane amount of energy they're using. You know, it's a hype cycle. It feels to me like the tech sector need the next big thing to push on. And I guess that's one thing that ad tech has to think. If it's part of your product and you have a product, then I think that that's got real use. If it's a standalone product, I don't believe it would be successful. Like, what? How are you going to differentiate yourself from someone who can build off an LLM? Like, you know, Rob Webster is probably a good guy to have in a podcast about this with his new agency. He talks about custom AI, right? We build for specific requirements for clients, not standardized AI. But look, I'd be interested to hear what people have to say about this. Like, it is crazy what's going on every day. Business headlines, AI. I stopped listening to some podcasts because that's all they fucking talk about.
But you still listen to our AI podcast, don't
Dot
you?
Dot is amazing, by the way. Listen to Dot. She speaks the truth.
I did want to mention
this, our own AI
podcast. Don't poo-poo it too much there.
No, I'm not. I think there is use for it for sure. But like, is it about efficiencies?
Don't set your soul on just AI, being an AI business, because there's more to it than that. And don't just be focused on everything we do and everything that powers us is AI powered. Yeah.
It feels like the use of the term big data, you know, 10 years ago, everybody was just bleating on about being a data business or utilizing big data or understanding and being able to interpret big data. Ultimately, I think AI has got such limitlessness to it that it will become some kind of a utility, but it will need to be put to use. And if it's not put to a specific use, everything will become very generic. And I hope nobody wants that, because that would be a very boring world to live in. And
generic and fake.
Absolutely.
Like, yeah.
And if we think about it from a perspective of marketing and advertising, I don't actually think that will drive more sales for stuff. It just won't. People are too complex. What appeals to you is different to what appeals to you is different to what appeals to me. So I just, or there might be some similarities. We might share some similarities, but we'll have all of these complex, nuanced differences that requires some diversity. Otherwise, we don't respond to stuff.
But this feeds back into other things like the new publisher, right? LLMs require data to improve the model, And then that's an opportunity for publishers. Yes.
Absolutely.
And the data...
Well, that's why Perplexity is interesting, right? The business model is returning money back to publishers. How much? Is it different? If it's a different matter?
Currently being sued by the News Corp, so I'm not entirely sure their entire model is being...
Well, because there will be a debate about how much is being returned to publishers, but at least they start with that business model as opposed to the likes of Google and Facebook that went, whoa, we're sending traffic to your site, though.
But think about what... Like, it just feels to me like... The Silicon Valley tech companies have strip mined the internet without remunerating people. And in the meantime, they're being valued at crazy valuations. There's definitely a line in the sand here. Like, they did it with search, but there was some kind of Faustian payback. With AI search, I'm not entirely sure what the Faustian payback is, because they strip mine sites for data to improve their models. They then display search answers, but where is the link back? Will we see traffic? Will we see the collapse? I mean, this is probably what AI is going to talk about, the unintended consequences, like the collapse of referral traffic, the collapse of publishers' ad businesses. This is why I'm not very bullish on sort of the mid to long tail, because they've been like strip mined. How are they going to, you know, put suits together against these massively backed companies? How do you sue someone like XAI? How do you sue OpenAI, which has a valuation of $100 billion? How do you sue Microsoft? So I do think there is, you know, how we got here has been very dodgy. I feel very uncomfortable with it, like, because it feels like they've built this on the back of content creators without properly compensating them.
Great. Finishing on a very nice, cheerful note there, Ciarán.
But it might wash your dishes and iron your clothes, so who knows?
Yeah, we hope so.
I'd be all right with that. That's fine.
Right. I'd be very happy for someone to come and wash my dishes and iron my clothes.
Change your nappy when you're 90 years of age.
You've now gone a step too far.
Excellent. Well, that was our eight pillars. We'd love you to get involved. We're really keen to get your thoughts on this. If you would like to know more of how to become part of Industry Review 2025, do drop me an email on john@thewirecorp.com and we can have a chat. Thank you all very much for listening. Normal service of your news podcast will be resumed next week. Thank you.